You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, August 18th, 2016. My name is Michael Brooks. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live and also to tape or from tape or pre-record, what have you, wherever. Steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, we have a batch of interviews that you have never heard before, but they were recorded at the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia with the great John Nichols, national affairs correspondent for The Nation. Dan Montgomery, the vice president of the American Federation of Teachers. And Alex Poreen, the editor of Gawker Magazine. Those are three interviews Sam did with at the DNC. They're all great. You haven't heard them before. And those interviews were a little bit longer range, which is one of the reasons that they sort of hung out in the vaults for a bit. So you're at the convention. There's obviously a lot of talk of the election cycle, but a little bit more policy, a little bit more longer-term trends, what the Hillary presidency will or won't look like, that type of stuff. And then I'll be back in the chair as I take you into the fun half where we will take your calls, your IMs. And what kind of sound we got today, Matt?
We have a lot of the Trump campaign is sort of aggressively going into the unskew the polls style denialism.
They're skewed. It's true.
So we have the Five and a Trump's special counsel on CNN reacting very defensively. And defensiveness is always a sign of deep personal security. So
defensiveness, yes. Defensiveness is the go-to for the self-contained. All that. Much more. We'll also do a little bit of Andrew Breitbart myth debunking today, which is important for our disgusting modern history. Really quick, did I ever tell you the story? I was almost booked on Fox News once a while ago, and someone who booked me for another show regularly booked me for another thing. Gave my name to someone at Fox, and I got a quick turnaround. Hey. You know, Michael looks good, blah, blah, blah. We'd like to have you on to debate something or other. And I would have been on, the morning show, the one when I think Gretchen was probably still there. So it was Kilmeade, Ducey, and Gretchen.
Fox and Friends,
yes.
You would have been one of the friends.
I would have been one of the friends. And we were going back and forth. It wasn't like a done deal. And I remember he's like, oh yeah, that's great. I don't remember what he said. Whether he'd already, I think he'd already seen something or read something, but he's like, I just want to, check out a few more things, blah blah blah. And I said, oh yeah, great. Just actually, it worked out perfectly because I just hosted the show yesterday. Go to the Majority Report YouTube channel and check it out. And I realized just as I hit send on my phone and went back to talking with my friends or whatever I was doing, that the latest video that had just gone up, I had called Brian Kilmeade, and I think the quote was literally the dumbest human being in the history of the planet. And then I wasn't booked. I burned some bridges there. Dan Montgomery, pre-recorded American Federation of Teachers, he's up first. Then Alex Poreen, the great Alex Poreen of Gawker, then the great John Nichols of The Nation. Then I'll see you on the flip side, taking you to the fun half.
Continuing our coverage of the DNC 2016 from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, I'm at the Wells Fargo, convention center. With me now is Dan Montgomery. He is the AFT, the American Federation of Teachers Vice President, also the head of the Illinois.
Yeah, President of the Illinois Federation of Teachers. We're a little over 100,000 everything, teachers, support staff, professors, university folks, community college, some public employees. Chicago Teachers Union is our biggest local. We have some small schools in rural Illinois with six teachers, so kind of runs the gamut.
So the AFT supported Hillary Clinton.
We did.
Fairly early endorsed.
Yeah. I think we were the first national union to endorse her last July.
Okay. From the perspective of the union, I mean, you have Bernie Sanders clearly has had an unambiguous relationship in terms of supporting labor. What's the calculation there by the AFT?
Well, I think, I mean, you know, the AFT did a lot of early polling of its members. You know, scientific, real polls, not just like, you know, here's an email blast. Though they did things like that, too. They did telephone town halls. They did more outreach to the membership than at any time that I can recall. I've been an AFT member since 1993. And it was resounding. It wasn't even close. You know, I was usually in most of the reach out, it was like well over 60%. Our members wanted Hillary Clinton. So I think that was the calculus. I think, honestly, we did it a little before Bernie really picked up some steam.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, I think we were thinking, yeah, she's going to get it pretty handily. She got it, maybe not as handily as we thought.
Right.
You know what? And I love Bernie. Like, I've loved Bernie for years, you know, like a lot of my teacher and union colleagues. But I think ultimately the feeling was he's great. He's going to continue to be great. He's done a lot of service from our point of view, moving the Democratic Party to the left, especially on economic issues. But that Hillary Clinton really is the one who can win the presidency.
I mean, it's interesting because I think there's always a transactional element with unions and politicians. I mean, we see it very distinctly in New York, in New York State. Unions membership tend to very much dislike Andrew Cuomo, I think with good reason.
Yeah.
But when it came time to challenging him in a Democratic, now this is not the perfect analog, but there's a lot of transactional stuff. The unions have to do business with a governor. Now, that's not so, there's not that same quality of transactional, between a president and a national union. But so what are their things, though, that you hope, I mean, let's put aside, because I think everybody understands that Donald Trump would be bad for unions, mm-hmm. bad for working people.
Yeah.
I mean,
disaster.
He's bad in a myriad of different ways, particularly when you talk about
sure.
education,
yeah.
from teachers down to actually the students in ways that we probably can't even imagine.
Right.
But what's the proactive agenda from a teacher's union perspective that you want a Democratic president to pursue?
Yeah. All right. Well, and let me just first answer that by saying, because this transactional issue you raise is a really good one. You know, I think the progressives learned a really good lesson in 2008 with Barack Obama. And a lot of people felt like, wow, we're getting this amazing progressive president. And, you know, he has been, I would argue. But especially in the first 4 years, I think people thought, oh, we elected him, job done.
Right.
You know, and the analogy, a good analogy, I think, is sort of like school. Right, you show up at school the first day, you enroll in class, great. Your job's not done. If you show up then on the last day, and you know, you're just going to get an F, right? You got to do all that work in between. I think that's the lesson for us, right? And that's a way out of the transactional model of politics, right? Is to say, we're going to elect the people that support our values, and we're going to work with them and continue to work on them to make sure they live up to those ideals. In terms of Hillary Clinton, look, I mean, it goes without saying, Trump is just horrific, right? You know, I like what Bernie did last night. He didn't get out and say, Hillary Clinton, because she's not Donald Trump. He went point by point through his platform, the platform of all the folks that supported him, and why that resonates with Hillary, why those things, she's going to carry that forward. You know, speaking in education, early childhood, she's been a tremendous and really early adopter. I mean, way back in her career, long before. I mean, I think the AFT for years has always been saying, look, research on early childhood is conclusive. Every dollar you put into that yields $8 to $12 later in life in terms of savings from, you know, criminal justice or mental health, things like that, remediation in education. That she's been on that hugely. Look at where she is now, partially thanks to Bernie on higher education.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this has been a tremendous crisis for us. In Illinois, we have a governor who has starved our higher education system, which is great. University of Illinois, one of the premier institutions in the nation, he won't sign a budget for it. So, you know, you have that on one end, and you have Hillary Clinton on the other end saying, okay, now for 100 families making $125,000 or less, we're going to find a way to get free tuition to a public, you know, for your university or college. So sort of from birth to higher ed, I think in the right. education front, she's great. I also really like the compromise that came out on the platform committee between the Hillary folks and the Bernie folks on charter schools, you know, which is a big issue for us. It's a huge issue in New York. It's a big issue in Chicago and other places in Illinois.
What was that
Well,
point?
So there was always sort of transparency and accountability in the platform, but I think it didn't push it, frankly, hard enough. The Democratic Party had not been pushing charters hard enough to say, okay, here's the thing. You can't – we're okay with charters under certain circumstances if – you know, people can collectively bargain within them. If you are held to the same accountability standards and transparency standards that regular public schools are, and by the way, if putting a charter up here in this neighborhood doesn't destroy the neighborhood school, and that's huge, because that's what we've seen in Chicago and in New York too, where the resources are going to a brand new shiny charter school, and they're not going
starving somewhere else
to the neighborhood public school down the street. Yeah.
Now, all right. So from people who are. All right, well, let me before we get into the charter issue. So from the perspective, okay, so you have, there's two different issues here. One is, does she have a record of supporting stuff that the union is supportive of, particularly from a teacher's union perspective? Early childhood education, more transparency in terms of charters, higher education, these are all big deals.
Yeah.
When the union sits down, do you guys, from a political standpoint, say, okay, here's our top three. Here's our two-year agenda, here's our five-year agenda, here's our 10-year agenda. We want card check, for instance, or we want collective bargaining within the context of charters. What is the AFT's top priority?
Well, I mean, first of all, we do sit down with it. We just had our own convention last week, actually, in Minnesota, so it's been a lot of convention going. And, you know, we pass a resolution. We create our platform, if you will, right, on our position on charters. I headed a task force for the AFT on the economy and inequality. We have, I think, just a beautiful working a lot off of the Stiglitz Rewriting the Rules report out of Roosevelt Institute saying, listen, we have got to move this agenda. We created that with the intent of saying this is going to be our agenda with the next U.S. administration, the next president. We hope it's Hillary. So, yeah, we have these positions. We go forward. I would say there's a few of them. One of them is fiscal. Right, all over the country and federally. I mean, we've been in this era of austerity, and the Republicans want more cuts, but what they sort of don't say is we've cut billions and billions of dollars out of program, whether it's in education, social safety, those sorts of things that show up in schools and affects people's lives. We've cut them already, you know. The federal government, special education, the federal government, they give very little money to states, as you know, for education. What little they give, it's in mostly in special ed and sort of Title I under the ESSA Act now. It used to be called ESEA. But they've never fully funded special ed. So the federal government has passed, you know, a number of laws saying this you must do, and they're good things. And they've really improved the lives of kids with special needs. But they've never fully funded it. So I don't think anyone expects they are going to fully fund their obligation, but we'd like a little more help, and states need a little bit more help. Illinois, the gap that Illinois gets back from the federal government is $1,700 a citizen in the state of Illinois. You know, we are subsidizing a lot of other states in terms of federal dollars, especially in education. So that's a big thing. We made a lot of progress with ESEA on rolling back the testing agenda run amok.
Yep, yep.
You know, AFT has long been a supporter back to L. Shanker of, like, high standards. We want high curriculum, and we still believe that. Unfortunately,
high-stakes testing is different than high standards.
Exactly.
Because you don't want that dictated by the inputs that students represent.
Precisely.
So that issue of high-stakes testing, do you have a sense that the Clinton administration moved differently from Obama? Like, were there hints? Because Obama came from a school district. Arnie Duncan,
yeah,
had already sort of, like, there was indications maybe, I don't know. And you would probably have a much better sense than this than I.
Stronger than just indications.
Right, as someone coming from Illinois, that this is where R.D. Duncan was going to go, where we're going to have the high-stakes testing, which is, you know, I mean, we could go on for hours probably about sort of the neoliberal implications of this, using the market as some type of measure, ignoring the inputs. Poverty is a huge issue for kids. If you put them the inputs in that way, you're going to get distorted figures, and you can't. You're going to screw up the way the teachers teach all this.
Yeah.
So without getting into all those, do you have an indication at the AFT as to who is going to be the Secretary of Education? Like, or where, or from what pool that's going to draw from? Because I would imagine for you guys, like, that's like the like, you know, the functional equivalent of like NARAL looking for who the next Supreme Court appointee is, or maybe even bigger in some ways, because obviously there's some Supreme Court stuff that's going to be really important for you
as well. Yeah. Well, so, I mean, you're absolutely right. We knew in Illinois what R.D. Duncan was going to bring to the nation, and it was unfortunate. I mean, I love President Obama. I think he's a historically great president on many, many fronts, except education. I felt like his education policy was pretty Republican, actually. And R.D. Duncan's from the sort of corporate, so-called reformer, education reformer mold. So I am absolutely confident, and I say this to all our members who might be, you know, quizzical or were supporting Bernie, Hillary Clinton will be much, much better on education than Barack Obama. The Hillary Clinton administration of the Department of Education will be better. I know that. We've met with her. We've talked to her. I use the term, she gets us. She really does in a way that, you know, I haven't seen another presidential candidate. I don't know. I mean, I think someone who was mentioned before President Obama chose R.D. Duncan was Linda Darling Hammond, who's an academic, although she was originally a teacher in Stanford, and is really wonderful and really bright, has done a lot of good work, I think has a lot of confidence of the teaching profession. She is repudiated very very strongly the sort of value added, this crazy testing run amok, you know, let's put a single number on a child, single number on a teacher, stuff that, you know, anyone who knows mathematics and statistics says you can't do. So, I mean, but other than that, I don't know. But, I mean, I think, like, a name like that is probably
in the mix,
I would
think. Do you
guys
not, like, have, like, names? Like, I mean, is that not one of the things that you do? Or is that something that you don't want to talk about? I mean, in other words, like,
well,
look, I mean,
you
guys came out early to endorse.
Let's get her elected first.
Well, but you guys come out and endorse her early, right? And the theory is this is going to give us more leverage with her. Because look, you're going to be happy with Bernie Sanders or Hillary Clinton, but we're going to endorse her early because we're going to be first in line. We're going to have leverage. She's going to see that we can be there. We can move some votes. And we have a list. We have a list of five people that we think are, at the very least, representative of the type of perspective that we want our Secretary of Education to have towards education.
Well, I'll say this, and I don't think there's a list right now or anything at the AFT. I mean, I kind of joked about it, but I really do mean it seriously. We've got to get her elected first.
Right,
and that's where I want our members concentrating, and I think that's our full effort's going to be. Once that happens, you know, I know this. Hillary Clinton has said to us repeatedly, you will have a seat at the table. And I think that means, and, you know, we'll be able to sit down with her or share our ideas about what kind of people would make a good choice. Or if she has a name that hopefully she'd run it by us and say, you know, does this person, you think, meet the standard for excellence that you would need in a Secretary of Education?
I don't want to get too morbid here, but I haven't had a chance to talk to any union members since Friedrich, the Friedrich case.
Yeah.
The Friedrich case that we've talked about quite a bit around these parts would have really destroyed public sector unions. It would have
been a body blow.
It would have eliminated the agency fee, and you'd have a lot of free riders who are basically asking the union to do all the negotiation work, and they would not even have to pay for the lawyers, for the photocopy, whatever is involved in negotiating.
Yeah.
That day that Antonin Scalia died and basically changed the course, I don't want to get too morbid, but honestly, like, you know, I mean, it is, I bring it up because the absence of that one guy, and had he died 3 months later, it would have changed the trajectory of public sector unions in this country and unionism broadly speaking. But he died 3 months earlier, and that's behind us now.
It's amazing, isn't it? You know, and I tell our members, I say, like, this presidential election, everybody always says the most important one ever, right? But I think about it. You're not just electing a president. You're electing two, possibly three branches of government in this election. Certainly the Supreme Court, as you say.
Without a doubt.
If you elect a Hillary Clinton, you're going to see a Merrick Garland or someone even possibly more liberal, and maybe two, maybe three more appointments in the next 4 years, say. That's hugely game-changing in terms of
decades,
American jurisprudence.
Decades,
right? Yes, decades, generations. So on the other side, the Senate, too. And you might think, I mean, if Hillary wins and wins strongly, I mean, I certainly in Illinois, I believe we're going to replace Mark Kirk, a Republican, a vulnerable, bad Republican, with Tammy Duckworth, who's a great congressperson. And I think there's a real sense that if Hillary wins, we can, the Democrats can take the Senate. So that's sort of like two branches of government. That's huge. It's huge. So, yeah, it was a relief. Although I will say this, you know, our approach to it was, I can't say this on the air, but a four-letter word that starts with the same letter as Friedrichs. Blank Friedrichs, because, you know, if we lose that, you know, we just have to be a better union, right?
Right.
And so we really believe this. It's all about members, member mobilization, grassroots, talking to your members every day. That's how we got to be unions. That's how we got to be strong unions. And we have to go back to that in places where it's not like that. So, and that's true whether Antonin Scalia is on the Supreme Court or not.
That's good. So to a certain extent, there's your cake and eat it too. You gear up towards a new, you have to examine the philosophy of what unionism means in this country. And then at the last minute, you have that introspection that you might not have otherwise had.
Right.
But now also, you know, still get...
It clarifies the mind a little bit, right?
I would imagine, indeed. Well, Dan Montgomery, AFT Vice President and... president, is it, of the Illinois AFT? Is that Illinois, IFT? Yeah.
It's IFT, Illinois Federation of Teachers. We're the AFT affiliate in Illinois.
All right. Well, I appreciate the work you do.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Great pleasure. Thanks, Sam.
Good to talk to you. Continuing our coverage of the Democratic National Convention 2016 from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, with me now is Alex Perrine. He is the editor of Gawker.com, and today is day two. We had a pretty big day yesterday. Mm-hmm. In and outside the convention, give me your, you know, give me your top line assessment.
Yesterday was like the please stop protesting day. I think that was the official theme. Was like, just like cut it out, guys. Like let's get to business. It was funny. I was in Cleveland last week, and I think other people have noticed this too. But there are way more protesters here in Philly. Like way more. Like left wing ones especially. Like out on the streets and in a sort of little encampment in a park nearby, and then even a few of them in the arena as Sanders delegates. Like mostly, I think there was a California crew that was like kind of rowdy. So like yesterday, they you know they brought out Elizabeth Warren and they brought out Bernie himself, and the theme was sort of we're listening. Like there's a lot of emphasis on how the platform is more progressive, the most progressive ever, and I think you know it was all done in the hopes that the rest of the week will be calmer and let them sort of sell their message without the left like continuing to cause a ruckus.
What do you think that message will be? Well, let me ask you this: was that effective? I mean, here we are in day two. I mean, it's a little bit difficult to measure, but give me a sense of whether or not you think that was effective. Because I'll tell you, in the morning, at 2 p.m, there was a sense. In you know maybe I'm projecting here, but in talking to people like yourself and other reporters, there was a sense like this could get really ugly.
This could go off the rails. It sort of felt like yesterday afternoon,
And in fact, that seemed to be the narrative. You know, when I dipped into cable television, that seemed to be the narrative. But by the end of the evening, I don't know. Maybe it was just me, but I didn't have that sense.
I don't really have that sense anymore either. We'll see how everyone is when business gets underway today. But I felt like, you know, I just took the subway here with a Bernie delegate and a Hillary delegate, like, sitting side by side having a friendly conversation, which was, like, the perfect, like, Tom Friedman in a cab kind of anecdote to, like, oh, yeah, there's my mental image for day two of the DNC. Like, everything is peace and harmony now. I don't know. Like, again, like, there are some people in the convention hall who might still want to, you know, chant and cause trouble. But I think, like, for the most part, it'll be smoother sailing from here on out.
Let me ask you a meta question. Will Durst, who is sitting right to your left, actually, and I, we're talking about this earlier. How much does sort of, in you know, you're a reporter, and I would imagine this is applicable in other situations, but it seems particularly so here. The conventions, it seems to me, their fundamental purpose is to project something to the American public.
Yeah.
The reporting is all, it's like, it's reporting on the sausage factory, right?
Yeah.
When
yeah.
really it's about what the taste of the sausage is. Because if you weren't here in this room, those 30 people are irrelevant. But I watched MSNBC after it was over, and like literally that was the only people they apparently could find
oh, yeah.
to talk to.
Yeah.
I mean, so how much, I mean, do you think about that? I mean,
yeah.
how problematic do you find that?
It's funny because we're it's hard to know what the standards of reporting should be for what is essentially a meta event in and of itself. You know, like there's no drama at these things. Like we know what's going to happen. Like I mean, with you know, in terms of the nominee will be Hillary Clinton and things like that. But yeah, it's always been true when you are at one of these things in the room and you're watching the speeches from the press stand seats, which are sort of behind the stage and way up. You have no clue what it looks like at home, and if you can sort of imagine in your head, though, I bet that's playing really well, but you don't know. Like you're honestly better off watching C-SPAN to know like how does it look to like the millions of people who are presumably watching this. One of the funny things is the reporting becomes by necessity a form of theater criticism in the sense of like we know this is what the Democrats are trying to do. Like, are they trying to deliver a message? Did they succeed at delivering the message? Instead of you know the what you would expect or what you would hope would be like the, you know, sort of substantive reporting about what are the, you know, what's in the platform, what does it mean, will it actually be implemented and things like that.
That is the amazing thing is that there was so much drama
yeah.
up until basically prime time.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, yes, there was 40, 50, I don't know, let's call it 200 people in the stadium. I don't even think it was that many.
I don't think it was that many either, yeah.
Who were booing at a time that it was inappropriate for people who want to project some type of unity. But, you know, 200 people out of, I don't know how many are in there.
Thousands in there,
of yeah. But the course of the day
yeah.
where, like, delegates booing Bernie Sanders in an all-Bernie, that could be indicative of something bigger. The idea that Debbie Wasserman Schultz at 4 p.m., people didn't know. Like,
yeah, they were like, is she going to show? Like,
is she going to show? Is she like in like you know some steamer trunk somewhere? Like, is she being shipped overseas?
I mean,
nobody knew. And all of the stuff that's happened with the platform has been, you know, and it's debatable as to whether or not a platform has any implications, but if we think it does, I mean, there was some real implications in terms of the platform.
Yeah.
Was there any speeches last night, was there any moments that stuck out for you that were important in terms of, like, going forward, in terms of what it tells us about the election and what it tells us about, perhaps, policy following the election?
Well, it was interesting. I don't think it was the best speech of the night, but it was notable that that Elizabeth Warren got the big primetime speech. Because it's a, you know, it's a signal that they're not scared of her economic message, which I feel like since she was, you know, first, I mean, there's a reason she's not in charge of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which is right. that Democrats didn't like how, sort of vociferous she was in terms of wanting to regulate the banks. So like giving her a primetime slot, even if it was mostly to bash Trump, which isn't, I don't think the best use of her talents. Even if it was mostly to do that, was like, all right, so this might actually be a Democratic Party that if it's not changing, if it's not like changing it, at least wants everyone to think it is.
Right, which is something,
yeah,
right?
Is.
I mean,
yeah.
They're making an effort. Now, with that said, it is Tuesday,
mm-hmm.
and tonight Bloomberg speaks.
Yeah, I know. Tonight we get Bloomberg. Tonight we get, I mean, it is, it's funny.
I don't want to ask you to make an assessment of a speech you haven't heard,
right.
but make an assessment of just the fact that he's here.
For all the talk of like party unity and how everyone needs to, you know, get along, if this Democratic Party is a tent big enough to encompass Michael Bloomberg, then I think everyone should be like letting the rowdy Bernie Bros like just giving them a pass, maybe. Like they haven't like presided over a you know, mass Muslim spying operation or the serial harassment of every young black male in New York City. So I don't know. It's an interesting choice.
I find it appalling.
Yeah.
And strategically, I guess I understand it. Like, I mean, let's for a moment just put our non-judgmental, and you're a very judgmental person.
Yeah, we are.
And I am a very judgmental person. And it's sad. But no, but honestly, like, put that, like, what are they thinking?
Yeah. I don't even understand, like, politically, like, from a purely cynical, strategic point of view, like, okay, so he is an ostensible former Republican mayor. So sure, they're being like, oh, Trump is, the Republicans are too extreme even for Bloomberg. Like, look, you like Hillary's mainstream. But, like, Bloomberg has no constituency. Like, we've been over this when he's threatened to run for president. Like, his constituency is Staten Island and the Upper East Side. Like, and that's not, like, how many swing states is that going to win you?
I mean, do they think that there are, I mean, it seems to me, my guess is, they think there's a bunch of, like, Mitt Romney.
Yeah.
Pre-Mitt Romney running in the 2012
right.
primary.
You know, like, the governor Mitt Romney.
Governor
right,
Mitt
yeah.
Romney Republicans out there who are repelled by Trump.
Yeah.
But not so much that they would vote for Hillary,
yeah.
and they need Bloomberg to sign off on them.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, we should wait and hear for the speech.
Right.
And maybe he's going to say, like, I've been lying this whole time. I think I'm a despicable person.
Right. I was a terrible mayor.
Yes. I'm going to rip my shirt off, see these nipple rings I've got on there. They're tied to electrodes, and I'm constantly shocking myself.
Yeah.
Some type of repentance. Or he's going to make the argument like, Donald Trump, even if you're as rich as me, you should be worried because he could make everything unstable.
Yeah, right. Like, the markets aren't going to like this.
Currency
like.
Won't be worth anything or, you know, whatever. Yeah. He'll crash the real estate market or, you know, he'll bring about a real revolution.
Right, yeah.
You know, or something.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know, like, what message could he carry? The only thing that I'm speculating now, and we're going to play this part of the interview after he's spoken. So
great. So well, I'm going to make a lot of very specific predictions. So.
It seems to me the only thing I could think beyond that is that he could spend a significant amount of time talking about guns.
Yeah, I think that's. I really think that will have to be the main focus.
Because Kane has been strong on guns, particularly
yeah.
from a guy from Virginia, and obviously Hillary Clinton made it a big issue because it was... I have a cynical assessment of that and a non-cynical assessment, but regardless, she made it a big issue
central,
in the primary.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so maybe that's what it is. Maybe, I don't know.
I mean, that would, I guess, be best case scenario is that he goes up there and talks primarily about guns. I don't know. We'll see. I also wonder what kind of reception he's going to get, you know, from a crowd that has been willing to boo people much less... objectionable than him. But,
they booed Elizabeth Warren.
Yes, exactly. If they're like hooting and hollering at Elizabeth Warren, like what kind of reception? And like the optics of that will be really fascinating too, to make myself sound like a complete asshole for a minute. But like, yeah, we're going to bring out Bloomberg, maybe probably
to prove
talk about
that
guns.
We're a big tent
yeah.
and watch him get
and
literally.
Just watch him.
Yeah, I wonder if there's second thought.
That's a good question. After seeing what happened yesterday, yeah.
Well, I mean, because they moved Bernie, right?
Yeah.
They moved Bernie based upon what was going on during the day.
Yeah.
I think they were afraid to hand out those Bernie signs.
Oh, yeah, to give them out earlier, yeah. I mean, he went on late. I mean,
he went on last.
Yeah.
Which is the most important thing, right? Because it doesn't matter if they have the signs after he's done talking.
Yeah, when there's no one
else. Because
they're
not going to be shoving them in front of everybody, person who's coming up. I mean, I wonder if there's people going, like, you know, maybe it would be nice for Mayor Mike to speak at like 5:30 p.m.
Yeah.
Eastern. Like, maybe that might be a good.
You know,
time.
He's a busy man. He might have things. He might have plans later tonight.
Like, right.
We might.
He could call in and say, like, I've got a party I want to get to. I bought a new hotel in Philadelphia, and I want to try out the expensive chicken dish is or whatever.
Yeah. He's got opera tickets, yeah.
All right, well, I've got you sitting here. I've got to ask you, I have no sense of whether or not you're talking about this, but you professionally, as someone who works at Gawker, you've been wrapped up in your own drama about a billionaire.
Yeah.
Who also, coincidentally, has spoken at a political convention this year.
Yeah.
Peter Thiel, right? Do I have that
Peter
correct?
Thiel, yeah.
Peter Thiel, who... all I know about him is that he thinks that we should all be living in a garbage scow with any laws somewhere, right?
Yes, he wants to live. Well, he doesn't want us to live, but he wants to live in the ocean far away from us.
Tell me more about Peter Thiel from your perspective and I just get your thoughts.
The very brief background here is Peter Thiel, the co-founder of PayPal, incredibly, incredibly wealthy Silicon Valley guy. A long, long time ago, Gawker, through what was then a Silicon Valley gossip site, reported a bunch of things about Peter Thiel that he didn't like, including we publicly said he was gay when he was sort of out in Silicon Valley, but not out to sort of the rest of the world. And then he began a decade-long campaign to bury us by secretly funding lawsuits against us, which is crazy. And then it eventually worked, sort of. We're still around, but we're bankrupt. So anyway, we're in Chapter 11 right now. We're going to be fine. But Peter Thiel...
But is he going to stop?
So the question is, like, we don't know if he's going to stop. I think, like, his vendetta was really against our publisher, the founder of the company, Nick Denton, and Nick will no longer be owning the site after next month. Nick is going to be stepping away. So, like, we're hoping it stops then. I think Peter Thiel was embarrassed by the publicity he got when, because he was keeping it, like, the point of secretly funding lawsuits against a company is you don't want people to know you're doing it.
Right.
So I think he was embarrassed by the backlash he got. Or he was just embarrassed by bad publicity. So he spoke in Cleveland, and it was a really lousy speech. It was very funny, because he's not an electrifying public speaker.
No,
by any means.
Were you surprised when he announced that he was a proud gay man? That there was the reaction he got in the room. I mean, this is a place.
Like the applause and
it wasn't that long ago. You know. Announcing you were a gay military personnel in a Republican debate got you booed.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, I wasn't surprised because the way the speech was sort of formulated was very careful, because that line effectively followed up a line where he said it's okay to, you know, I don't care what bathroom people go in, which was like, it's okay that we are opposed to... you know, equal protection for transgendered people, because I'm giving you permission as a gay man to be opposed to that, and I won't care. And, like, what they're applauding for is, like, him saying, I'm gay and I don't care if you, like, actively discriminate against...
Right, I give you a license to be a bigot.
Yeah.
What was interesting, now that you mentioned, is the way that he phrased it was, like, we shouldn't be talking about this.
Yes.
And so, to people who think... the right wing has completely overreacted to this.
Yeah.
And they're making a jihad out of it because they just hate transgender people.
Yeah.
He's right. But what he was saying is that this should have never come up in the first place.
The idea of it is
what he was saying to his people. That was sort of a fascinating, smart thing for him to do from the perspective of, like, like, you know, being a dick.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Totally. Yeah.
And not wanting people to know. I mean, that seems to be his MO. Right?
It is.
Like,
yeah.
A lot of passive aggressive.
Stuff. So here's some other fun facts about him: is that he also thinks he will live forever. He believes that through like with crazy medical experiments that only rich people can afford, rich people will live forever, and he will be one of them. So eventually,
do we know what he's doing? I mean,
there are rumors. Yeah, there are. I don't know how much I can say without confirmation, but there might be vampirism involved. Vampirism.
Let me talk about this. Let's just hypothetically.
Yeah.
We're not talking about anybody that is a known quantity.
Yeah.
But just like when we're talking fantastically.
Yeah.
If you were to write a fiction book.
Yeah.
Totally fictional.
Yeah.
Based on no one.
Yeah.
But about a billionaire.
Right.
Maybe it's Mike Bloomberg. Maybe it's not Mike Bloomberg.
It could be anyone.
Could be anybody. And they were attempting, based upon what you know about technology that exists
yes.
in the world, to live forever.
Right. What would they be going about doing?
In your opinion, just based on that fictional
so
book.
In my darkly satirical dystopian novel
right.
about this billionaire, what they would be doing is finding healthy young people and paying them literally for their blood to be transfused into them.
Okay, check. Unbelievable.
Yes.
You just keep, it's all, the key is the blood. You keep the blood young.
Yeah, it's, yeah.
And, but now they wouldn't be, like, just siphoning any out of, like,
like
it's all voluntary.
Well, so, yeah.
Theoretically, in your dystopia.
Theoretically. I think that the financial transaction element of it adds an extra sense of everything being right in the world.
Right.
You can literally...
That's what makes it just.
That's what... Yes, yeah.
If somebody's making a dime...
Yeah.
So, if I'm Nick Denton...
Yeah.
I'm a little concerned about my next endeavor.
Right, yeah.
I wonder if he wants to, like, buy the Majority Report. Just for the attention...
When I get back to New York, I'll ask, yeah.
It would be... Interesting. You get like in the sights of a billionaire. That's a little problematic, broadly speaking.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, the idea that, like, you know, we've seen this with elections, frankly, where billionaires are like,
right,
why wouldn't I see if I can make this guy president?
Right.
I mean, it cost me what amounts to nothing.
Yeah. And so this is, you know, something similar happened to Mother Jones, you know. And when we're talking, I mean, this is like the level, this is just a very real, like, example of what this sort of hugely disparate incomes and wealth actually means in real life. Is like, yeah, this is chump change for him. And the fact that we were fighting these increasingly frivolous legal battles for years, like, added up to millions and millions of dollars. We're a completely independently owned media company. We're not owned by a corporation. Not yet. Next month we might be. He killed an independent media company, and it was a bargain for him, but yeah.
Well, did you guys have a sense that these were related over the years, or was it just the Hulk Hogan?
Hulk Hogan,
right?
Was the biggest one, but
right.
yeah.
But did you guys have a sense, like, would you, like, 2 years ago, were you guys sitting around going, like, why do we attract so many people trying to sue us?
I don't know. There wasn't, like, what happened was around 2 years ago, I think, it became apparent that this one attorney, Charles Harder, kept being the person who sued us. Like, mm-hmm. it was the same one over and over again. And then there were rumors, someone is bankrolling Hulk Hogan. Someone is paying him to keep this going. Harder kept... starting new suits. So eventually it became really clear by last year someone was behind this. We had no idea who. We had no idea who until I think Forbes finally got the story and they finally reported it. So it was crazy. It's crazy to see, like, your sort of inter-office conspiracy theory, like, come true. Like,
right.
Like, we were all like, who's doing this? Like, which billionaire hates us? You know, there's a list. Like, there's a master list of
right.
billionaires it could be. But, yeah.
Were people shocked insofar as, like, it's one thing to sort of speculate.
Yeah.
It's another to sort of, like, find out, like, oh, yeah, shit, this is happening.
It really, I mean, it was really surprising, especially that, because I thought it would be one of those sort of unreported stories for years and years and years. So it was surprising just to have it all come out there in the open like that. Like, yep, this is it. This is what happened. And it was sort of galvanizing too to be like, our enemy has a face and it's a very hateable one, and we can actually sort of, like, take pride in fighting against that sort of person.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds a little bit like the mentality over there. I can imagine
yeah.
he would enjoy it. Like, did people in the office, and you don't have to tell me this, but. Like, start doing, like, prank phone calls or stuff like that? Like, I feel like I would.
We were looking for him in Cleveland. We had a lot of questions. I wanted to ask him if he was Team Kim or Team Taylor. But no, I think if he has a, you know, if he's, he probably spends a small fortune being unreachable by people like us.
Alex Perrine, thanks so much for sitting down with us.
Yeah, my pleasure.
I've never been alone long enough to know.
Continuing our coverage of the 2016 Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, joining me, very happy to have us have him join us, John Nichols. He's the National Affairs Correspondent.
That's what we call me.
The Nation Magazine. All right, so John, it is day two.
Yeah.
We are hours away from the roll call, maybe moments. Why the roll call? I mean, in the past, 2008, Clinton basically...
She interrupted the roll call.
Yeah, and said, we don't need it.
Yeah, yeah.
We don't know. Maybe that's going to happen this time.
I believe
maybe.
There will... What I'm hearing is you may have a little theater, but it will probably come at the very end.
It'll come at the very end.
That's what I'm hearing, but I don't know that. So, yeah.
So what is... I mean, why?
I mean... I can tell you exactly why. If you go to Bernie Sanders' office... on the wall, he has a plaque of Eugene Victor Debs, who was the great American labor leader and democratic socialist, ran for president 5 times at the start of the 20th century. People who are historians of the left in America know that Debs outlined ideas like Social Security, you know, all sorts of other things, labor law reforms that eventually influenced what became the New Deal. But they also know that Debs got about 1 million votes. That was, you know, and that's well remembered by historians of
right.
the left. Bernie Sanders got 13 million votes as a Democratic Socialist, and he's got about roughly 1,900 delegates to this convention, and there is a bit of history to that. I wrote in 2008 that Hillary Clinton should go through the whole roll call and count every vote because the first time a woman had gotten this many votes.
Right.
I thought that was important.
Right.
I don't like it when we say, oh, party loyalty trumps history. No, I want to see the first African-American candidate get every vote that candidate gets. I can tell you,
right.
I think I can tell you accurately how many votes Channing Phillips got at the 1968 convention as the first African-American nominated. You know, and so what's going to happen tonight is a little bit of that. And it's not just democratic socialism. It's other issues in that, but it's a value.
Is there any, in the historical significance is obvious as you outline it. Is there any... political salience. In other words, is this to be able to say as almost like as if it was like proof of concept? You know, 13 million votes started as an unknown candidate, nationally speaking.
3% in the polls.
3% in the polls, no money, no corporate backers, proof of concept. Here's 13 million votes. It can be done.
Yeah, and count them. Let's see what we got here. Yeah, that's the whole point of it. And, you know, in our earlier little soliloquy there, we emphasized democratic socialism, which is a part of this. You could also emphasize the opposition to traditional politics, this new model of $27 contributions, grassroots. You could also say that you've got millions of young people casting their first votes,
right.
The first campaign they ever got excited about. You want to show them that it comes full circle, even if you don't win. Because this is one of the complicated things about politics. And I think it's one of the things our media does horribly, except for, of course, this brilliant show.
Thank you.
And that is suggests that politics is always winner-take-all.
Right.
There have actually been some very good books on this recently. That part of what makes politics so brutal is the notion that every election is the end of all time. Right? And one of the wonderful things about politics is building over time towards something that becomes epic. I will be thinking on Thursday night about Shirley Chisholm.
Ah.
Shirley Chisholm ran for president in 1972. They didn't let her in some debates. She had to sue to get into the debates. Shirley Chisholm, you know, was not treated overly well, even by constituencies that she thought would be with her.
Unbossed.
Unbought and unbossed. She got to that convention, and you know what happened? Humphrey sort of fell apart as a candidate. Many of the African-American delegates for Humphrey voted for her. She ended up getting about 153 votes on the floor of the convention. I'll be thinking about her on Thursday night. Not because she's more important or anything like that, but because she, you know, she kind of went up a couple steps on that ladder and
opened up the door a little bit.
I mean.
Yeah.
And so, and I think it matters that I and a lot of other people remember that. when I tweet about Shirley Chisholm, I mean, I could set out tweets that get like 3 retweets. Nobody cares, right? I tweet about Shirley Chisholm. I throw a picture of her out, 250, 400, 500. Mm. You know, there's a heck of a lot of people that go, yeah, I like that. That's cool. So what I'm saying is, you know, we're 40-some years on. I'm thinking about her. 40 years from now, I want to give people who want to think about Bernie Sanders, you know, some tangible evidence. I want some, I don't know what we'll be doing in 40 years. We probably won't be tweeting. But right. I want some, you know, kid to be able to, you know, tap into that.
It'll all be, you'll just be able to think it. And then it'll immediately pull into the stream.
Or something, yeah.
And so, all right, so let me.
My robot will do it.
So, assuming tonight is the night where the convention pivots to the official end of the primary, to the launch of the general election, there's an agenda to brand Clinton in a certain way where they see deficits. I mean, we've talked about that a little bit, and of course it's all just speculation. But staying with Bernie Sanders for a moment, okay, the trajectory here, like what happens? I mean, I think there's been a lot of people, Clinton supporters, strong Clinton opinion advocates, who had no idea why Bernie Sanders was doing any of this. And yet, here we are on the other side of that platform debate, real movement in the platform, real reform in terms of superdelegates and whatnot. I mean, substantial, to the extent that politics are real, substantial changes. It's rhetorical, but it's got to start with rhetoric. Okay, so what comes next?
Okay, what comes next is a presidential campaign with a guy named Donald Trump.
Right.
We're going to pay a lot of attention to that. It's going to be real, and you're going to find a couple things, even in the next couple nights. You're going to find that Tim Kaine is better on his feet than anybody expected. One of the stupidest things I've ever heard is the argument that Tim Kaine is boring. I've covered him in rural Virginia, seen him working in coal country. The guy's a good politician. He's going to do a good job. I disagree with him on some issues. I'm not, you know, here to tell you he's a perfect player, but I'm just telling you, people are going to... There's going to be a little bit of a love affair there. People are going to really start to like him. That's important. Clinton will, I mean, look, there's probably people who have been working on this Clinton speech for a year.
Right.
You know, this is, one assumes is going to try to deliver not just a speech that wraps up where she is, but really does pivot and put it forward. If she is savvy, it will not be overly about Trump. You have a little Trump hit, but then you're going to go into a vision. You need an alternative vision.
And also, I think, like, you know, humanize her. She's humanized slightly.
Absolutely.
But I'm talking about in terms of Bernie's movement.
Yes. For Bernie's movement, there will be a Bernie presence during this campaign. He has already reached out to state parties, and said, I did pretty well in your state. Do you want me to come and campaign there?
Mm.
And, boy, I'm telling you, the response he's gotten, from what I understand, very positive.
Oh, that's
like
good.
There are people saying, you know, we got our congressional district. We'd like you to go to. When can you arrive? So people know where the young folks are. They know where the where the blue collar folks are. They know where the energy needs to be upped. And this is a fascinating thing. Bernie Sanders is going to go out there, and you're going to see him in a different context. I don't think you will ever see him as the stone cold down the line party man. But you will see him as an important campaigner, somebody who brings in movement stuff to this broader presidential context.
We got 45 seconds. This phenomena of someone like Elizabeth Warren was brought in 2014 into red states to campaign. This phenomena with Bernie Sanders, is that new? The idea of progressives on that edge of the party in the past 20
it's
years
not new.
Going into these campaign?
Not new. There's a gentleman named Jesse Jackson. And in 1988, when Dukakis, which Dukakis didn't make it, but in 1988, when Dukakis got that nomination, one of the things they did was they said, Mr. Jackson, you are very, very popular in some areas. You've made connections not just with your African-American community, which is a building block, but also you did some really amazing stuff with young people, with farmers in some places, with...
But that's 88. I'm talking in the past 25 years. We've gone through an era.
In the past 25 years, the Democratic Party has made tragic errors quite frequently. Not always. I mean, Barack Obama built a coalition on himself. Party's made a lot of errors on how to reach out and how to build out. You want to talk about a 50-state strategy? You know where I would send Bernie Sanders? Utah. Because right now, the polls in Utah show it's relatively close. If Gary Johnson keeps getting a portion of that vote out there, if Bernie Sanders goes in there and really rallies young people to add to the base that Hillary Clinton has, you might find a few electoral votes you didn't expect in a weird place.
John Nichols, The Nation Magazine, always a pleasure. Thanks so much, John.
Honored, my friend.
Well, there you have it, everybody. I'm Michael Brooks. Those were three great interviews that Sam did at the DNC. Links to all to everybody that he talked to, Dan Montgomery, Alex Perrine, John Nichols, on the website. We're going to go to the fun half. I look like I'm drinking beer, but this is water. Where you can join us at 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. I'll open up the IMs. I've got a bunch of stories to get to, including Jeet here has a good piece in the New Republic showing how all of these new Trump campaign moves are pointing towards what we had talked about and Vanity Fair talked about 2 months ago, which is that this is about Trump media, which is going to slide right in between Alex Jones and Fox News, and it's going to be great. It's going to be fabulous and incredibly successful. We'll talk about that. We've got sound from Donald Trump's special counsel, Michael Cohen, who's an interesting guy. And Eric Bolling is getting called out on The Five. What's going on over there?
The Five is fracturing.
The Five is fracturing. More from that focus group in that Triumph did in Ohio, and a whole bunch more. The IMs are on 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. We'll see you all on the flip side.